This is 1A. I'm Jen White in Washington. Coca-Cola, Target, and other major American companies have stopped or limited advertising on Facebook this month. This is in response to a boycott campaign designed to pressure the social media company into cracking down on hate speech on its platform. YouTube, Reddit, Twitter, they've all taken action in recent weeks to block white supremacist groups and restrict hate speech. But who defines what is hate speech? When do these restrictions run contrary to our constitutional right to freedom of speech? Does the First Amendment also guarantee freedom of reach, to have our voice amplified by technology and algorithms? Do some social media platforms not only allow hate speech, but incentivize it? The freedom of speech is something we care deeply about. Our name, 1A, refers to the First Amendment of the Constitution. Joining us now to help us sort through all of this, Daphne Keller. She's the Platform Regulation Director at the Stanford Cyber Policy Center. Daphne, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Also with us, Louise Matsakis, a staff writer at Wired covering Amazon, online culture, and China. Louise, welcome back to 1A.
Hey, thanks for having me again.
So, Daphne, let's just start with the basics. Does the First Amendment of the U.S. Constitution protect hate speech?
Does most people understand that term? Yes. You know, a lot of what we are arguing about today is speech that could be considered lawful but awful. You know, it is stuff that most people don't want to see, that a lot of people find highly offensive, that a lot of people think platforms should ban as a matter of moral responsibility or ethics. But it's not something, for the most part, that you can use the law to prohibit, because the government couldn't pass a law prohibiting this stuff. And that puts us in a situation where the whole question is, what will platforms voluntarily do under their own discretionary terms of service?
Talk a little bit more about that moral obligation social media platforms are facing right now.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think a lot of people think that it's irresponsible to, for example, permit sharing a really horrific piece of content like the video of the massacre in Christchurch. There was a huge rush for platforms to get that down. I think there was a near consensus in the media coverage that that was the right thing for them to do. But in many cases, users are perfectly free to share that and have a First Amendment right to do so. And so, you know, what we're talking about is what platforms should do. And the boycott really illustrates that a lot of their decisions about what they should do are driven by public perception, by advertiser preference, you know, by a set of economic pressures that right now seem to align with what I think a lot of Americans want, but might not in the long term. You know, maybe we don't want advertising dollars to be ultimately what determines what speech and content we see online.
Well, Louise, that awful but lawful content on the internet is nothing new. Why is it getting so much attention right now?
I think there's a couple of things happening. One is obviously this huge advertiser boycott. I think that a number of other platforms saw these major advertisers pull out of Facebook and said, okay, we're going to clean up our house. You know, you saw Twitch removed some of the president's streams. You saw Reddit removed, you know, thousands of communities on their platform, the majority of which were inactive at the time. I think to preempt advertisers from pulling from their platforms as well. This is also a historic moment, against racism and, police reform. This is also, the middle of a pandemic and, an economic downturn that a lot of these companies are looking at shrinking advertising dollars to begin with. So I think it's both kind of cultural forces and truly, economic considerations as well. And this is part of a long trend for these platforms over the past couple of years, where they've really curbed a lot of things like hate speech, white nationalism, after, like Daphne said, events like Christchurch, which were live streamed on Facebook, or, several of these very violent attacks. Either the perpetrators were radicalized in some of these online platforms, or they, shared their manifestos online after the fact, or, before they committed these atrocities. So I think that there's been kind of a reckoning over the past couple of years. But the moment right now, I think, is both cultural and, frankly, economic.
How do platforms determine what is and what isn't hate speech, Louise?
So they have a set of community guidelines, and Facebook and all these platforms will say that in creating those community guidelines, they consult with a variety of civil rights organizations, you know, different sorts of groups, groups that, you know, maybe are more in support of free speech, groups that say, you know, hate speech is really dangerous. And they craft these rules that are ever changing. Basically, there's no way that they can account for every circumstance. Culture is changing so much. These platforms, you know, often are home to literally billions of users. So it's a constantly changing landscape. And these rules are, you know, constantly being tweaked. And I would say that Facebook in particular, and also YouTube, I think are very susceptible to pressure in the U.S. You know, while they operate all over the world, I think that a lot of the pressure to change and alter their community guidelines often comes from, you know, U.S. civil society.
Now, Louise, you talked about how these rules governing hate speech on platforms, they're changing. How effective has this sort of community standards approach to monitoring speech on these platforms actually been?
I think it's been effective in that a lot of, you know, the white nationalist groups on Facebook, for example, have disappeared. A lot of the, you know, racism on YouTube has kind of been curbed. But I think that overall, you know, these platforms are gigantic and they're always going to miss something. And there's always going to be people who say you didn't do enough. And there's always going to be people who say you're censoring my free speech. So I think that, you know, the approach has definitely matured and I think has grown more effective over time. Facebook will say, you know, we are, you know, much better at identifying hate speech than we were even 1 or 2 years ago. But at the same time, really relying on the platforms entirely to kind of decide how you basically people can express themselves online. You know, there's not a lot of other places to go besides these, you know, enormous platforms.
You know, when you look at the current approach social media platforms are taking right now, Daphne, are there things these platforms should be worried about legally that they're not taking into consideration?
Well, you know what? I think a lot of the legal pressure for now actually comes from outside the U.S. Mm-hmm. So, for example, a couple of years ago, the European Commission, an EU-level governance body, negotiated a deal with YouTube, Twitter, Facebook, and Microsoft, where they agreed to use their terms of service to take European legal definitions of what counts as hate speech and then prohibit them globally, you know, as a matter of their discretionary power under their terms of service. And that was, you know, widely seen as responding to the threat of regulatory action against them in Europe. You know, you if you don't agree to voluntarily enforce our speech rules, we're going to pass a law and you're not going to like it. So Europe has really been in the driver's seat of a lot of the changes for the past couple of years. And I think what's interesting that we've seen recently is that there is more pressure coming from the U.S. So you get things like, you know, the Trump administration threatening to change the laws in ways that will punish platforms if they don't follow the White House's preferred editorial policy. So in a way, the platforms are much more caught between competing visions from powerful governments that have the ability to punish them, where European governments generally want them to take down more, and more conservative Americans and the Trump administration generally want them to take down less.
Still to come, when conservatives don't feel comfortable on mainstream platforms anymore, where do they go? We'll talk to the founder and CEO of Parler. It's a social network that's home to some right-wing activists who feel unfairly censored by other social media platforms like Twitter. We're speaking with Platform Regulation Director at the Stanford Cyber Policy Center, Daphne Keller, and Louise Metsakis, staff writer at Wired. And we heard from Jeff on Facebook, who says, when you suppress free speech, it squishes out somewhere else. I'm Jen White. You're listening to 1A from WAMU and NPR.
The past is never past, and every headline has a history.
I'm Ramtin Arablouei.
I'm Rund Abdelfattah, and we're the hosts of Throughline, NPR's history podcast.
Each week, we go back in time to better understand the present,
bringing lesser-known stories and perspectives to the surface.
Subscribe and listen to Throughline from NPR.
Today, we're looking at recent moves to crack down on hate speech and who gets to distribute hate speech online. Our guests are Platform Regulation Director at Stanford Cyber Policy Center, Daphne Keller, and Louise Matsakis, staff writer at Wired. And I want to bring another voice into the conversation. John Mates is founder and CEO of Parler. It's a self-described free speech social network. It's become home to many right-wing activists who feel unfairly censored by other social media platforms like Twitter. John, welcome to 1A.
Hi, thanks for having me.
And we also asked you what you thought about the balance between protecting free speech and preventing online harassment and the spread of hateful ideals. Here's some of what you had to say.
My name is Alicia Beale. I'm calling from Ellicott City, Maryland.
This is Paul from Macon, Georgia.
Gregory Gleason from Centennial, Colorado.
Freedom of speech is incredibly important. However, I think that online platforms are not just speech. They are promotion.
4 years ago, over 60 million Americans voted for Donald Trump. Two of the most oft-cited reasons being he tells it like it is and he says the things I can't say.
I browse Reddit a lot. I play games online a lot. And I can tell you people are awful when they have the mask of anonymity to hide behind.
It is well within the business's rights to choose what voices they amplify.
Banning quote-unquote hate speech doesn't solve the problem. It just drives it underground to resurface who knows where.
You know, if they want to be that way, I say let them be that way in public, which is their constitutional right, but they don't have the right to be that way on a private platform.
Thanks, Alicia, Paul, and Gregory for leaving us those messages. Daphne, I'm going to come to you first. What is it about Reddit's policies that left space for it to become considered a home for hate speech?
Well, you know, I think among a lot of people who study this, Reddit is seen as a kind of a role model. I have to say
a positive role model or a negative role model?
Well, in some ways, a positive role model. They're very different from Twitter or Facebook or YouTube because all of those platforms try to devise just one set of content rules that are going to be right for all of their users. And of course, the users, you know, we never agree on what the right amount of violence or nudity or any of these things, profanity, might be. And having a single rule for everyone and one size fits all doesn't work very well. So what's always been different about Reddit is that they have different subreddits with different moderators and different speech rules. And people can sort of opt into the discursive community that has the rules they're comfortable with. But what Reddit, you know, up at the top, the central management has done over the years is increasingly decide there are some things that are beyond the pale and that as a company we're not going to allow, you know, even if the individual moderators do want to allow them. So they've crept more and more into prohibiting things across the board and, you know, further restricting the range of discretion that those moderators have. But the basic model of having different places you can go for different speech standards, like the difference between going to a bar and going to a church, I think is something to be applauded.
John, how are your guidelines on Parler different than Twitter and other mainstream platforms?
Every rule on Parler comes from either the FCC or the Supreme Court, with the exception of spam. So basically the concept that we tried to take is we don't want to get into trying to define things that haven't been able to be defined by our country, such as hate speech and things of that nature. Instead, we rely on definitions like fighting words, things that might make you want to fight somebody if you were in public talking to them, or, you know, we don't allow spam, or was it nudity or pornography as well. Those are things that were defined by the FCC. And so that's how we're taking an approach to this, is try to be completely objective and let people get their points across.
Do you have any regulations around user speech at all?
Well, yes. Yeah, we do. And like I said, it's all around the FCC or the Supreme Court. And that's not because we're legally required to. That's because we figured that's the best way to be objective is to try to use legal definitions rather than to make up our own. You know, a lot of times you're seeing these companies are using different terms in their rules that are so arbitrary that people often find themselves having trouble getting their points across.
How concerned are you about Parler devolving into a place where bigotry or conspiracy theories or harassment start to bubble up?
Well, the kind of the way it's designed is that everybody opts in and out of content. I don't really foresee it being a huge issue. The problem that I kind of see is more the harassment side. Seems to be more that stems more from anonymity online, as one of your call-ins had said, and that also stems from people kind of abusing the internet to say a lot and to basically bully people off of their posts in the comment section. And so those are our two biggest concerns right now.
Daphne, is there something particularly unique about the way a company like Parler creates their policies versus a platform like Twitter?
Well, it's kind of a fascinating experiment to try to start from Supreme Court case law or from FCC rules, although the latter is a little weird because the FCC rules are generally designed for broadcast or cable. And so saying that that's the right thing for an internet platform is a bit of a leap. But it's fascinating to look at it and try to apply those rules as if they were clear, which I think any law professor will tell you they're not. But I think it will ultimately run into exactly the problem that Louise was describing with Facebook's rules. You know, there's just such infinite iteration of human misbehavior, and people come up with new ways to be horrible to each other all the time. And so the platforms are constantly having to adapt or reinterpret their existing rules in ways that they don't have precedent for. And the Supreme Court doesn't have precedent for it either. So I think Parler is going to be in the same position as everyone else, having a set of rules and then having, you know, a million judgment calls to make that ultimately force it to make its own policies.
Well, Fox News host Laura Ingraham interviewed you last year, and she described your site as a way to fight back against liberal bias and alternative. Let's listen.
Here's an incomplete list of recent punitive steps taken. Personalities Alex Jones, Milo Yiannopoulos, and Laura Loomer have been permanently banned by Twitter. Candace Owens was suspended by Facebook for 7 days for saying white supremacy was not as big a threat to America as fatherlessness. Now, one company is stepping into the breach, however, to solve this. Parler is a Twitter-like platform that was launched last year. It's already attracted a number of powerful people, including Senator Mike Lee and Trump campaign manager Brad Parscale.
John, do you see your site as an alternative for right-wing activists who have been banned from other sites?
If they view us as a place that they can go, then they're welcome to join. But we view ourselves more as a true community town square, and that's our goal is to facilitate discussion between people all across all ideological groups. The idea is that if you censor people online, they're just going to go somewhere else, and they're still going to vote the way they're going to vote. They're still going to do the things that they're going to do. You're not changing anybody's mind by censoring them. You're just kind of removing them from the discussion.
So when sites like Twitter or Reddit or YouTube crack down on hate speech, and as you say, it sends users looking for a new home, do you want people with bigoted messages to come to your site?
Well, the problem isn't that they just crack down on hate speech. I think they took that definition too far and have been interpreting it too loosely. And it's become basically the definition of whatever the moderators at these companies don't like is now determined as hate speech. And they're crossing the line from just trying to keep a safe community to enforcing their political bias on people. And so that's what we're trying to avoid with these rules. And additionally, you know, some people may say some things that are not very nice, right? They might have opinions that we don't like or that society rejects as a whole. And so our point of view on all of this is, as long as they're not abusing the platform for spamming people with their message, and they're keeping it to their profile, and they're keeping the discussion realistic, we don't care what their viewpoint is, as long as there's basically some kind of facilitation of discussion there so that people can talk to each other. That's the goal.
We got this comment from Glenn on Facebook. He writes, "Remember when fighting for free speech meant fight for the speech you disagreed with the most, not only speech that doesn't offend anyone." But Daphne, what I'm hearing in this conversation is that these social media platforms, they continue to develop, gain users, a conversation shift, the way people use the platform shifts, and the companies themselves are sort of scrambling to keep up. Do you think that's a fair assessment?
I think that's a fair assessment. And what they're trying to keep up with is some mythical, agreed-upon standard that would make everybody happy and makes everybody stop being mad at the platforms. And we're not going to arrive at that, you know? And so I think the best way forward is more about having the platforms do a better job of being transparent, be clear about the rules are, what the rules are, be clear about how much content is being taken down and give users appeals and, you know, let them challenge the takedown if they think that it was a mistake or that it was biased. Release data so researchers can look and say whether there is bias, because there are people across the political spectrum who think that that their group is the victim of political bias. This isn't just something coming from the right, although that's what gets reported the most in the U.S. So I think moving toward greater transparency so we can just understand what is going on is the first step to having a more coherent political and societal response.
We're discussing hate speech online with Platform Regulation Director at the Stanford Cyber Policy Center, Daphne Keller, staff writer at Wired, Louise Metsakis, and John Mates, CEO of Parler, a self-described free speech alternative to Twitter. And we're talking to you. We heard from Greg, who says, if you take a close reading of the First Amendment, it only protects free speech in the public sphere. One now has to decide what is meant by the public sphere. I'm Jen White. We'll hear more from you and our guests in just a moment.
Comedian Nicole Byer doesn't consider herself body positive. She just accepts herself as is.
I hate that there's a name for, like, not hating a part of who you are. Do you know what I'm saying? Like, it's insane.
Nicole Byer on her new book, Very Fat, Very Brave, and How to Love Yourself. Listen to It's Been a Minute from NPR.
This is 1A. We're continuing our conversation on free speech and hate speech. Let's turn back to our guests now. Daphne Keller is the Platform Regulation Director at the Stanford Cyber Policy Center. Louise Metsakis is staff writer at Wired, covering Amazon, online culture, and China. And John Mates is CEO of Parler, a self-described free speech alternative to Twitter. John, is it possible to have a free marketplace of ideals when social media algorithms decide whose voice is heard and whose isn't?
Well, I think complex social media algorithms that reprioritize people's content based off of what they think that you want to know or based off of some kind of internal metric are definitely infringing on that. Our perspective has been that we want to leave everything chronological and opt-in so the users decide what they want to see. There are a lot of issues that came up with that. We have actually three feeds that are chronologically based with filters to solve those problems. But I understand why a lot of these other platforms have gone in and made these complex algorithms to reprioritize people's content based off of what they think that user wants to see. It optimizes their experience, but it's also really ruined the platform and kind of taken away from people's ability to opt in and out of what they want to see. People's feeds are getting more littered with content that the platform wants them to see rather than the content that they've asked for. And so that's kind of a dangerous precedence in my opinion, because the idea is that society or the community as a whole is being determined, you know, what is important for them to see and what's not important for them to see by the platform, a central point, rather than by the individual. And so our goal was to give that back to the community.
Louise, what's your take on the role social media algorithms play in this conversation?
There's no doubt that algorithms help determine what you see. You know, Facebook and some of these other platforms have said, you know, you control your feed, you can, you know, move all of these levers to decide, you know, what you want to see in your feed. But there's no doubt that the algorithms play a role in what gets amplified, you know, what gets the most viewership on these platforms. And I think it is important that we continue to, you know, interrogate them. And to Daphne's point, there's certainly not enough transparency about how they work. And I think that there's a lot of contradictions. For example, I think Facebook has been one of the largest targets of conservatives who say that they suppress their viewpoint. However, if you look consistently on Facebook, almost every day, the top 10 posts are from conservative pundits and publications, and they often get amplified through Facebook's algorithms. So I think that that shows that we don't really have an understanding of how these algorithms function, you know, completely, and there needs to be more transparency about how they work, especially as, you know, newer social media platforms like TikTok, which rely, you know, much more on these algorithms than, say, Facebook does.
Some have also said that Facebook hasn't done enough to put a stop to political propaganda on the platform. CNN recently interviewed Facebook Vice President for Public Affairs Nick Clegg on this.
Politicians will make very vituperative claims about their opponents and often, you know, will make caricatured claims about their own virtues. That's politics. That's always been the case. And we're not there to sort of vet what politicians say. We don't want to get in the way in a democracy, and particularly in an election year like this, between what politicians say to each other and voters who in the end are the boss and who have to make their own judgment at the ballot box. What we can do, which is why we're launching America's largest voter information and voter registration ever, effort ever, is to encourage people to vote, because in the end, the way by which people can make their voice heard is by participating in the election and doing so safely and confidently that they know where, when, and how to vote.
Louise, those comments were in response to some posts President Trump put on Facebook about mail-in voting. Why do you think platforms like Snapchat has stopped promoting the president's posts altogether? Twitch temporarily suspended his account, unlike Facebook, which just labels his posts.
So the Twitch issue was a little bit separate because that was about hate speech. That was about comments that President Trump made about immigrants. However, with Snapchat and Facebook and Twitter, they all have rules around election integrity. You know, you cannot, confuse voters, you know, by saying that, you know, this is where you have to vote or, you know, this is not voting day. Voting day is next week. And these rules are all designed to prevent election interference. And I think that the concern with some of Trump's comments about mail-in voting were that they were kind of, you know, coming up against those rules about election interference, you know, by questioning the integrity of the election, was Trump, you know, interfering in the November election. So I think that it is kind of tricky. And these platforms, like we've talked about here, are dealing with an evolving circumstance. You know, what do you do when you have a president who, you know, every other week is saying that the election, which is only 4 months away, you know, might be invalid? I don't know what you do there, because it contradicts another rule, which, you know, we just heard Facebook discuss, which is about we don't want to get in the way of quote unquote politics. Where is the line between politics and election interference? I don't think that, you know, the average person on the street is going to agree with the next person who you ask. So it's really tricky for these platforms to draw that line, especially with a figure like Trump, who, you know, on the weeks that he's not talking about mail-in voting, he's talking about conservative bias at Facebook and Google.
Well, Mark Zuckerberg had previously agreed that Facebook would expand their policy on hate speech, banning ads that scapegoat minorities, immigrants, asylum seekers, racial groups, or claims that those groups are threats. Daphne, what's your take on Facebook's approach to this issue so far?
Well, I have to say I feel bad for them, right? If they're in the position of taking down speech by politicians or declining to take down speech by politicians, they are doing something very high profile with the near certainty of antagonizing powerful people no matter what they do. You know, people who can punish them with changes in tax regulation or changes in privacy regulation. And so it's incredibly fraught. That said, they're stuck with it, right? Like, they have to make decisions. And even saying we've decided not to make decisions is in itself making a decision about what speech to tolerate. I think a lot of people saw Facebook as being broadly kind of more acquiescent to the president's political pressure in response to the executive order that he issued a couple of weeks ago. Basically, Twitter labeled things and kept on labeling them. And as was mentioned before, Snap made some changes and Facebook did not.
John, I'm curious, what are you learning as you watch Facebook and other social media platforms, specifically around this issue of political speech and posts from politicians? What are you observing and trying to learn as you continue to grow Parler?
Well, is once they started moderating and getting involved in political content, they've gone down a rabbit hole where now they have partial responsibility for everything all of these politicians are saying. And in the previous example, you brought up mail-in voters and the president talking about voter fraud. They viewed this as election interference, yet this is an ongoing debate. That topic is an ongoing political debate between two opposing sides. By saying that this is election interference for questioning that concept, that's them getting involved politically and putting their bias, you know, basically out there and saying anybody who holds the opinion that mail-in ballots are, you know, questionable, anybody who holds that opinion is not allowed on our site.
So even though there's no evidence that there's wide-scale mail-in voter fraud, you still see this as stepping into this conversation in a way that isn't proper for these platforms?
If people as a society as a whole feel that it's not safe and they want to talk about it and they don't feel that it's a secure way to vote, then they should be able to discuss it regardless of what a few people claim to have evidence or not have evidence, right?
But is it different when it's coming from a politician, when it's coming from the president of the United States? That's not just, you know, me and my neighbor having conversation about it on Facebook. That's the president. Does that come into play at all for you?
No. You guys realize that what you're advocating for is censoring his speech and censoring his ability to talk to the voter base. Would you rather him not share his views publicly and then have people be voting for somebody not knowing where they stand on policies? I mean, it's not a good premise to say, hey, we're the leading, you know, free world. We're a country that believes in the freedom of the individual. But if our world leaders or if our leaders say something that we don't like, we're going to take their content down. And you're not going to know what they believe when you go to the voting, you know, for the voting booth. That's wrong. That's against the First Amendment. So, granted, these companies have the right to do it because they're private, but the general concept behind this is wrong.
So, Louise, I think this is where we get into this issue of what people feel as compared to factual evidence and how social media platforms are trying to thread that needle. What have you found in your reporting around this?
Well, to talk about the issue specifically, you know, I think the question that Facebook is weighing there, you know, to Daphne's point, I do not envy them whatsoever, is it worse to, you know, add some sort of disclaimer to what Trump said or some context there, or, you know, to try and, you know, get a rein on what he's saying, or, you know, potentially have an election that people, you know, don't believe was valid because of, you know, Trump's constant, you know, assertions to the contrary, to say that, you know, it was not a true election because of these mail-in ballots. It's an impossible decision that they have to make. And in my reporting, I found that almost always when these high-profile content moderation decisions are made, they are almost always controversial. You know, you have civil society groups that say Facebook didn't go far enough. You have conservatives and other people on the right who say that they've gone way too far. And especially, I think this is an incredibly difficult task because we're not just talking about the U.S. context. You know, often these rules have to translate across hundreds, thousands of cultures around the world. And how do you do that? How do you have one set of rules for how everybody should express themselves around the world? And I think that that really comes down to this fundamental point that I would say everyone agrees with, is that it's an enormous decision for only a handful of companies. And maybe that's the real problem, is that, you know, they have basically monopolized speech around the world, except for perhaps in China. And maybe that's too much responsibility that we're giving to, you know, one set of companies. But on the other hand, I don't really know if we want governments regulating these platforms either, because to Daphne's point, the rules and regulations are still extremely vague when it comes to broadcast and radio. So do we really want a slow-moving, complicated, vague government regulation of these platforms either? I don't know. It's a really hard question to answer, and almost nobody is happy.
Well, we got a couple of other comments on Facebook. Chris writes, those who can't argue ideas suppress those they disagree with. And Jacob tweets, regulating hate speech is bigger than fostering dialogue. Hate speech has real-life consequences. We're going to have to leave the conversation there. Daphne Keller is the Platform Regulation Director at the Stanford Cyber Policy Center. Daphne, thanks for speaking with us.
Thanks for having me.
Luis Matsakis is a staff writer at Wired covering Amazon, online culture, and China. Luis, thanks.
Happy to be here.
And John Mates is CEO of Parler, a self-described free speech alternative to Twitter that's become a space for some conservatives. John, thanks for joining us on 1A.
Thank you. This has been great.
This conversation was produced by Emmanuel Johnson and James Morrison and edited by Matthew Simonson. To learn more about them and the rest of the team, visit the1a.org. This program comes to you from WAMU, part of American University in Washington, distributed by NPR. I'm Jen White. Thanks so much for listening, and let's talk again tomorrow. This is 1A.